From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Round Richmond 96 double!
It's Super Bowl weekend, and today, Fresh Air talks football with Hall of Fame writer Ray Didinger. He's covered the game for over 40 years. Didinger will explain how the Super Bowl has evolved and talk about coaching, concussions, and the coded language of quarterbacks.
He says on two, when he says hut, hut, the ball gets snapped.
Hut, hut!
He says on one, the ball goes on the first hut.
Also, Terry talks with author Ann Patchett about her book, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. It includes personal essays about getting married, divorced, married a second time, and deciding not to have children. And Ken Tucker considers bro country, country music's macho subgenre.
If you ain't a 10, you're a 9.9. Tipping and spilling that homemade wine on your tighter t-shirt.
First, the news. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. The Super Bowl draws a TV audience of more than 100 million people, spawns countless parties, and generates a week's worth of chatter about the halftime show and the best commercials. But at the heart of it, the Super Bowl is a game. And on today's show, we're going to take you inside the world of pro football in a way we hope you'll find interesting, even if the Super Bowl is the only game you watch or half-watch every year. Our guest is Ray Didinger. He's covered football for 40 years for a variety of media organizations, including NFL Films. He's written 10 books, been named a Hall of Fame writer in Canton, and is currently an analyst for Comcast Sportsnet. We spoke with him earlier this week. Well, Ray Didinger, welcome to Fresh Air. I enjoy watching football on television, but I know a lot of people for whom football holds no appeal at all. What do you like about football?
It's always been my favorite game. Right from the beginning, I liked football the best of them all because I just found the strategy of it, the complexity of it, the intricacy of it. I just found it fascinating. I mean, basketball to me looked kind of like a simple game. Baseball to me was a game of cameos, you know, the pitcher, the hitter, the fielder. Football was the one game that I thought was the most inclusive. It was the truest team game. I mean, nothing happens on a football field if everyone doesn't have a part of it. I mean, you can have the greatest quarterback in the league, but if the guys up front don't block and the guys don't run the pattern or catch the ball, then that quarterback isn't going to win a game. Everybody has to contribute on every single play.
One of the ways that the game has changed over the years is that it's gotten much more complex, and particularly offensive plays. I mean, they're complicated when they call them, and then when after the team breaks the huddle and goes to the line of the scrimmage, you'll often hear the quarterback shouting these incomprehensible things, which may be changing plays, changing formations. And I thought we'd just listen to just a little bit. This is a little bit of audio of Peyton Manning when he was a quarterback for the Indianapolis Colts. We're going to hear him call a play in a huddle, and then we're going to hear what he says when he goes to the line of scrimmage. Let's listen.
We're going dice right, ice cream, alert, 654, Jose. To hat! Check, Brown, Richmond, 96, double! Check, oh, what a flare. Brown, Richmond, 96, double! Hot, hot!
Okay, Ray Didinger, Brown, Richmond, 96, double flare. What's going on here?
That's a quarterback calling a play in the huddle, the quarterback has to tell everybody in the huddle, the other 10 guys, exactly what they're doing, what their responsibilities are. So he's talking about where the backs are set. He's talking about the blocking assignments, and then he talks about the play. Then he gives you the play. He gives you the formation. He gives you the blocking assignments, and then he calls the play. And what the snap count is. Is the ball going to be snapped on one, two? That's the hut-hut. If he says on two, he means when he says hut-hut. On the second hut, the ball gets snapped. If he says on one, the ball goes on the first hut. Then they go up to the line of scrimmage, and Peyton Manning does this better and more extensively than any quarterback that I've ever seen, is change the play at the line of scrimmage if it doesn't look to him like the play that he's walking up to the line of scrimmage. If he looks at the defense and he knows the play that he's called doesn't really have a very good chance to succeed, then he will change the play at the line of scrimmage. And everybody has to, all the other guys have to listen to, okay, it's off now. And what he will do is he will say generally sort of check, check, which means, okay, now we're out of that play. And then he will go into his next series of plays. And you will hear him say a lot of things that a lot of it is code, and a lot of it is meant to throw off the defense.
It's gibberish to confuse the defense.
Yes, he'll say a lot of stuff, but there will be within what he says at the line of scrimmage a word, a code word, that will tell everybody that what I say next is the play.
Okay.
So he'll go into, 23 Brown right, blah, 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 blah. But the code word may be Toledo, and when he says that, then the players know, okay, now what he says next is the play. So this sort of belies the idea of the dumb football player. I really don't think you can be truly a dumb guy and play this game at the NFL level. I mean, there's a lot of thought that has to go into it.
Right. When you're hearing him say Brown, Richmond 96, double flare, I mean, if I'm a lineman and I'm getting ready to engage in an extremely violent encounter with a defensive lineman and I'm looking at where his feet are because he may be shifting and that's going to affect where and when I can hit him, and I've got to be listening very carefully to my quarterback, don't people sometimes get confused?
Always. It happens a lot. And you have – this is what coaches call mental mistakes or mental breakdowns. And very often they lead to game-changing plays. A guy won't get overpowered and knocked to the ground. He'll just go in the wrong direction. He'll block right when he's supposed to block left. And if you have one guy, you could have the five guys up front or six guys up front all do everything that they exactly are supposed to do. But if one guy doesn't get the play right, or if one guy goes in the wrong direction, all of a sudden he leaves a wide open gap. And then his man comes through clean and gets a clean shot on the quarterback, and that might cause the fumble, might cause the interception, might cause the play that breaks the game down. Now, everybody else did everything right, but if one guy breaks down, then the whole play breaks down.
The other thing that always fascinates me is when a team can run a no-huddle offense. They can run nine plays without ever gathering in the huddle. You can literally call every play, shout it at the line of scrimmage, easily heard by the defensive players, and it works?
Yeah, and that's where the game is headed now. It used to be that when an offense would huddle all the time after every play, they would go back and they would huddle up. Well, you had 30 seconds there. And so the defense had an opportunity to see who was in the huddle, what personnel was on the field, and then the coach could mix and match based on what he saw. And they had time to do that. But if teams are moving at this faster pace now and they're snapping the ball every 15 or 20 seconds, which more and more teams are going to, the Eagles have certainly gone to that, it really is to the advantage of the offense because the defense is stuck with its personnel. If they've got the 11 guys out there, they really can't change very much. But it is more challenging, and it's particularly challenging if you're on the road and you're playing in the other team's stadium. Because the fans are hip to this. The fans know what's going on and the fact that these guys have to communicate and hear at the line of scrimmage. So when the visiting team is trying to do this and the quarterback's trying to get the word out to his receivers as linemen, the crowd, and you'll see this, and Seattle does it better than anybody, they just make this deafening roar that it makes it hard for guys to hear. Now, for the home team, it is a very funny dynamic. When the home team's got the ball, in fact, in Denver, when Denver has the ball and Peyton Manning is doing all this stuff, they put up on the scoreboard, quiet, Peyton at work. And the crowd gets very, very quiet. I mean, remarkably quiet when you're talking about 70,000 people. So they let him do his thing at the line of scrimmage, and everybody can hear it.
Another thing we're seeing in the game is a lot more concern about injuries, especially concussions. I mean, there's been this long – been a lot of research. There's now a lawsuit, a court settlement that may or may not stand that can affect, dozens, hundreds of players. But it's also affected how the game is played and how players are treated. What's your take on that?
It has. And it's really changed the way the game is officiated and the way the league approaches it and the kind of game that they're – the kinds of hits that they're trying to take out of the game, the way that I would say they're kind of trying to re-educate the players into playing a whole different style of football. They're trying to get the players back to playing the way guys played years ago, which is tackling with their shoulders and not with their heads. They're trying to get guys to take, you know, not use their helmet as a weapon, not to use their head as a weapon, but to tackle with their shoulders and block with their bodies, and to try and minimize that kind of contact in the head area. It's made it very hard. It's made it very hard, especially for defensive players. Some of this the league wanted to create because the league back in the 70s, because there were a lot of really great defensive teams, the Pittsburgh Steelers, Steel Curtain being a perfect example, defense was taking over the NFL. Big, strong, physical teams were taking over the NFL. And as a result, most of the games tended to be 17-13, 13-10, 9-7. There wasn't much scoring. And the NFL was concerned that it was hurting the product, that they think the fans, they don't want to see that. They want to see touchdowns. They want to see long passes. They want to see big plays. So they began putting in a lot of rules that made it hard for defenders, that limited the kinds of hits. You can't – oh, no, you can't hit them that way. No, you can't hit them outside 5 yards past the line of scrimmage. Can't hit the quarterback. Can't do this. And so they try to create a more wide-open, explosive offensive game, which they certainly have done. I mean, every year now you see the point total just keeps going up and up and up. So they've tried to accomplish two things. Number one, make it a more explosive, wide-open, entertaining offensive game, and at the same time maybe make it a safer game with a little less contact and trying to preserve the receivers. They now have this thing they call a defenseless receiver. You can't hit a receiver once the ball kind of goes past him, or if he's not in a position where he catches it and can defend himself. If he's suspended in the air reaching for the ball, used to be you could hit him and knock the ball away. Now, very likely, if you do that, you're going to get a penalty. So they're trying to make it. They're really trying to do that, but it's. I think it's made it very, very hard for defensive players and defensive coaches to deal with and try and slow down these highly skilled athletes.
The game now is such a huge thing that it has to affect the players and the coaches differently. And you've observed how coaches deal with this. There's a 2-week gap between the game that gets them there, the conference championships, and the game itself. How do coaches get their players in the right mental and emotional frame of mind to do this?
The downtime is a factor. There was a real pattern there for a number of years where sometimes there wasn't 2 weeks. Sometimes there was only 1 week after the championship game. And generally speaking, those games were better games, better played, more competitive, cleaner, not as many mistakes than the games with the 2 weeks. And it confirmed in my mind that I think that the players are so into routine and they're so used to playing every week that having more time actually throws them off their schedule. And actually having more time to think about playing in the Super Bowl throws them off schedule.
So how do coaches handle it?
Some very poorly. I mean, the coaches, I've always had this thing, and it almost always plays out to be correct. I watch how teams handle the week leading up to the game or the 2 weeks leading up to the game. And the first team and the first coach that starts complaining about distractions, complaining about their hotel, complaining about their practice field conditions, they're going to lose.
And that's the coach talking. How do you know the players are distracted?
Because the players take their lead from the coach.
They really do?
Yeah, for the most part, they do. If the coach is rattled and the coach is unnerved and uncomfortable in his surroundings, that will be transmitted to the players. The coaches that have handled it the best and been the most successful are the ones that have said to the guys, look, just have fun with this, okay? It's a Super Bowl. Have fun with it. And Chuck Knoll, who was the coach of the Steelers in the 70s, was exactly like that. I mean, Chuck said to these guys, hey, look, you know, you spent your whole life. You've worked your butt off to get here. Have fun. You know, come on, just go out and have fun. The press is going to come in here. They're going to talk to you for an hour. They're going to make you famous. They're going to put you on television. Enjoy it. Have fun. You know, whatever they ask you, answer the questions. If you feel like making stuff up, make stuff up. But have fun with it. I think that Bill Parcells is another example, the great Giants coach who just went in the Hall of Fame. Parcells, I think, did a very smart thing. Some coaches try to tell players, look, it's just another football game. You've been playing this game from the time you were little kids. This is no different. This is just another football game. It's not. And I think the coaches that try and tell the players it's just another game are doing them a disservice. I think, you know, Parcells would tell them and say, look, this is going to be a different week for us. We're going to be staying in a hotel. We've got these interviews every day. And pregame warm-up is going to be a circus. There's going to be movie stars on the field. There's going to be circus animals on the field. It's not going to be like any other game we've played. Everything about this is going to be different. Okay, so be prepared for it.
Ray Didinger is a football analyst for Comcast Sportsnet. We'll get back to our conversation after a quick break. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Well, I'm the best corner in the game. When you try me with a sorry receiver like Crabtree, that's the result you're going to get. Don't you ever talk about me.
Coming up, we will talk about the Seattle Seahawks' Richard Sherman and his incendiary postgame comments as we continue our conversation with Ray Didinger. Also, Ken Tucker considers bro country, country music's macho subgenre. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. This Super Bowl weekend, we're taking a journey inside the world of pro football. Our guest is Hall of Fame football writer Ray Didinger. He's covered the game for more than 40 years and written 10 books. He's currently a football analyst on Comcast Sportsnet in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. People in Philadelphia remember the 1981 Super Bowl when the Philadelphia Eagles got one of the two times they made the big game. And the coach back then was Dick Vermeil, who was known as just a guy who prepared relentlessly, worked around the clock, was a real disciplinarian. They were playing the Oakland Raiders.
Correct.
That kind of took a different approach. Tell us about that one.
Well, you're right. I mean, you characterize it very well. Dick was a guy who literally slept in his office, drove himself hard, drove his team hard. The Oakland Raiders were the Oakland Raiders. I mean, back in those days, they were a really good team. And Al Davis was the owner, and he brought in all these kind of renegade guys that nobody else wanted. And so they played it fast and loose. I mean, Dick Vermeil was a guy that set curfews for his players. The Oakland Raiders laughed at curfews. I mean, they were two totally different teams. You couldn't imagine two more different teams. And they get to New Orleans, which is the ultimate party town, and Dick tells his guys right away, okay, curfew is 10 o'clock at night. You're not going to leave the hotel. We're going to practice all this time, and this is going to be our schedule. Boom, 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 boom. And the Raiders just said, hey, boys, have fun. and so on Sunday comes the game, and the Raiders came out and looked very loose, very relaxed, and played a really good game. And the Eagles came out, and they looked tight, and they looked nervous, and they didn't play at all like they had played during the season. And the Raiders wind up winning the game easily, 27-10. And a lot of people in the retelling of that now say it's all because of that. It's all because of Vermeil and because of his approach. The Eagles were uptight, and the Raiders were the Raiders, and they were loose, and that was the difference in the game. I kind of think that's overstating it a little bit. Vermeil's approach was the approach he took all season. I think when you take a team from the beginning of training camp all the way to the championship game, I think it would be a mistake to try and do anything different. Practice in three and a half hours, that's what they did all year. If they had gotten to New Orleans and Dick had said, hey, boys, go out and have fun. French Quarter's right down the street. You know, go down and have a hurricane on me. I don't think the players would have known how to handle it.
All right, let's talk about the game itself. I mean, we often focus on quarterbacks, and of course we have Peyton Manning here, one of the best near the end of his career, playing at an incredibly high level. And the Seahawks have Russell Wilson, this young, promising quarterback who runs as well as throws. But the big story is Richard Sherman, this cornerback, this defensive player for Seattle. And it's really because of the remarks he made after he made the critical play, breaking up a pass that ended the championship game that got the Seahawks there. And so why don't we listen to this? People who have paid attention to know this, but this is Richard Sherman being interviewed by Aaron Andrews on Fox right after he made the big play to get them there.
They're sending down to the field and get Aaron Andrews.
Joe, thank you so much. Richard, let me ask you the final play. Take me through it.
Well, I'm the best corner in the game. When you try me with a sorry receiver like Crabtree, that's the result you're going to get. Don't you ever talk about me.
Who was talking? talking about you.
Crabtree, don't you open your mouth about the best. Or I'm going to set it for you real quick. L.O.B.
All right, before... And Joe, back over to you.
All right, well, we saw...
And that is, of course, Richard Sherman trash-talking the receiver, Michael Crabtree, saying he's the best. Were you surprised at this performance?
No. No, not really. I mean, I would have expected that Richard would have had some kind of outburst because that's him. I mean, he is the number one in a league full of trash talkers. Richard Sherman is the number one trash talker in the league. And given that moment, given that audience, given that stage, yeah, I expected that Richard Sherman would go off. I didn't know quite in what direction, but we soon found out. And Here's the thing that's lost on the average fan who only sees these bites. Richard, there are a lot of guys that talk trash and can't really back it up, that they're more trash talk than ability. Richard Sherman talks a lot of trash, but he can back it all up. He is one of the two best cornerbacks in the entire National Football League. There's a guy in Arizona named Patrick Peterson who's close. But Richard Sherman, on a week in, a week out basis, is probably the best corner in the league.
Corner is the guy who usually plays one on one on a receiver. His job is to defend against pass plays, and he does it really, really well.
Extremely well. I mean, and when people want to talk about this game, I mean, he is a very, very key player in this game. I mean, there's trash talkers that are irrelevant. I mean, when the Eagles went to their last Super Bowl in Jacksonville, Freddie Mitchell, who was like their fourth receiver, was trash talking all week, but Freddie Mitchell was not going to be a factor in the game. Richard Sherman is going to be a big factor in this game because obviously the Denver Broncos are a team that loves to throw the football. That they're a team that's built around Peyton Manning and his receivers. And that's going to be the part of their game that they're either going to win or lose with their passing game. And so they're going to have to go against the Seattle secondary. And Richard Sherman is probably going to be matched up on Manning's favorite receiver, who's Demaryius Thomas. And whoever wins that matchup is likely going to win the game.
Sherman has made a lot of the fallout from those comments, people calling him a thug on Twitter, him seeing kind of a racial element to all that. What do you think is going on here?
I don't think it has anything to do with that. I just think it's poor sportsmanship. I don't think it's a matter of black or white. I think it's a matter of right or wrong. And I just think that it was just poor sportsmanship on his part to call out Michael Crabtree. Had no reason to. I mean, you broke up the play. You kept him from catching the pass. You won the battle. Good for you. Leave it at that. And for Sherman to turn to the 49ers bench and give the choke sign, again, poor sportsmanship. Win with class.
It was insulting. Yeah. Was that part of them? He's a smart guy. I mean, went to Stanford, right? Was he maybe making himself a star in a league when it's hard for a defensive player to be a star?
I think there's a little bit of that. I mean, the league is really about the offensive players, as we've talked. I mean, it's about the quarterbacks. It's about the receivers. You kind of have to work hard as a defensive player to draw some attention. Well, Richard Sherman's been able to do that. And I think that's part of it. I mean, a little bit of it is his own marketing. I mean, he's smart enough to understand that. But for people who the only thing they've seen of Richard Sherman is that film clip, and they now think, well, boy, this guy must really be a fool. No, he's actually quite a bright guy. He went to Stanford. He had a 3.7 grade point average and is working on his master's degree in communications. The idea that he's sort of this doofus, not true, but he is a guy that and the other thing about him is I understand a little bit about what's driving him. He was a fifth-round draft choice in the NFL, which means a lot of teams passed him over. There were a lot of questions about whether he was going to be good enough to play in the NFL. He felt as if he didn't get his due respect. He felt that he's always been trying to prove himself. And I really do think each time he goes out to play, each week when he goes out to play, he sort of reaches this kind of emotional pitch that I'm going to prove to these people that I can really play. He's long since proven that. But I think he's one of these guys that kind of feeds off that kind of energy and this idea that I'm still proving myself. And I think when you catch him fresh off the moment, as Aaron Andrews did there right after that game, all that emotion is right there on the surface. And I think that's what you saw.
Ray Didinger is a Hall of Fame football writer and currently a football analyst on Comcast Sportsnet. You'll find a longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org.
I got that real good, feel good stuff.
Up under the seat of my big black jacked up truck, rolling on 35s, pretty girl by my side. You got that suntan skirt and boots, waiting on you to look my way and scoot. Your little hot self over here, girl, hand me another beer, yeah.
Within country music circles, one of the most debated topics is the rise of so-called bro country, a brand of macho good time music that's dominated the country music charts over the past year. Rock critic Ken Tucker has some thoughts on the trend as he reviews new albums by Jason Eady and John Pardee.
Girl, I'm gonna warn you, I'm leaving California. First thing in the morning, me and the band are loading up the van. We gotta go, we got another show. We're headed out to Reno, Jackson Hole. After that, I don't really know. But if you're looking for a good time, we can make it some memory of Bakersfield tonight. And then I'll write you a song you might.
If you listen to country music radio at all, you're aware of a dominant subgenre of song. Tunes about getting in a pickup truck with a case of beer, asking a pretty gal in shorts and flip-flops to come along and party hardy with you. This formula has yielded big hits and even awards for young male acts such as Luke Bryan, Jason Aldean, and the duo Florida Georgia Line. The music critic Jody Rosen popularized a phrase for this genre, bro country. Bro as in brothers, as in male bonding. One of the better, less tedious and repetitive examples of bro country can be found on John Pardee's new album, Write You a Song.
Now don't forget your flip-flops. We can stop by the quick stop. Get some jerky and a 12-pack. No telling when we'll be back. I got a cooler in a truck bed. Couple towels when we get wet. Cause you know we're gonna jump in. It take a little midnight swim. So baby, let's go take a dirt road. Kick it back, find a good song on the radio till we get lost in a sunset falling. Lay a blanket by the creek where the moon peaks over that sycamore tree. And it won't be anyone watching. No one watching. Now there ain't nothing wrong.
On the second verse of Up All Night, John Pardee hits all the bro country bullet points. 12 packs of beer, flip-flops, implied skinny dipping with a babe. But where other bro acts tend to polish their cliches to a glossy pop sheen, Pardee maintains a certain roughness and a clear fondness for more hardcore honky-tonk music. Take, for example, this fine nouveau drinking song, What I Can't Put Down.
I knew the first time should have been the last time I ever let the whiskey touch my lips. Cause the devil wears black and he goes by Jack, and he's really good at helping me forget. I thought it was cool when I was a kid, walking around with the cigarette lid. On that old dirt road I let my first smoke, and I knew right then it wouldn't let me go. And it's all or nothing, so keep it coming. Let that feeling run through my veins. Ain't no stopping, keep on rocking, yeah. It seems I'm always, yeah, I'm always picking up what I can't put down. Yeah, I'm always picking up what I can't put, down.
Pardee, with his amiably raspy voice and clever way with wordplay, is doing a good job of straddling two markets. What the large mainstream country demo wants, which is pop country rock as party anthems, and the smaller segment of the market that prizes its own concept of authenticity. The lineage that carries back to George Jones and Merle Haggard, even unto Hank Williams. One of the more determined of the younger traditionalists is Jason Eady, whose new album, Daylight and Dark, is filled with twangy stories of drinking all by one's lonesome. No parties or flip-flops for this guy.
It's been a long day driving and I'm here in Oklahoma City. I've been drinking at this bar for an hour now. The
feeling all filled up. That's the only thing I'm feeling. That I remember where I am. I see the problem now. It's whiskey or nothing up in Oklahoma. The beer up here, it just won't do, do. Line them up, bartender. It don't have to be your finest. Okay, whiskey treats me better than that old 3-2.
Years ago, Jason Eadie had a cult hit with a song called AM Country Heaven, which sprayed a lot of buckshot at bro country music. In the press release that accompanies his new album, Eadie says, "I've never been interested in the mainstream, and I've never had any particular interest in hits at the expense of quality. I think this is an example of protesting too much. Surely singers Eadie admires, such as George Jones, were interested in both quality and hits." And sure, in a better world, this adroitly phrased song called One Too Many would be a radio staple for Jason Eadie.
I always seem to start off with the best of intentions. I just need a little something to unwind. Just looking for some comfort, then I find that I have one too many.
Ultimately, both John Pardee and Jason Eadie have to confront the dilemma of all young country musicians: how to navigate the pop current that keeps country music commercially viable, while connecting to a past that fewer and fewer listeners are aware of. It's not a matter of being either a sellout or authentic. It's a matter of making music that enough people want to hear to sustain a career.
Ken Tucker reviewed new albums by Jason Eadie and John Pardee. Coming up, we'll hear Terry's interview with author Ann Patchett. Patchett's collection of personal essays is called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Sony Masterworks, with Simona Dinnerstein's new album, Bach, Inventions and Sinfonias, featuring the 2- and 3-part inventions, at Amazon now. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, recognizing exceptionally creative individuals. This year's MacArthur Fellows are at macfound.org. And from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, with the comedy Enough Said, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus, James Gandolfini, and Catherine Keener. Now available on demand. This is NPR.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're going to listen to Terry's recent interview with author Ann Patchett. Patchett's latest book, called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage, isn't exactly that. It's a collection of personal essays that tells the story of an unhappy marriage, followed by a quick divorce, a strongly defended refusal to get married again, and eventually a happy second marriage. Ann Patchett's novels include Bel Canto and State of Wonder.
Ann Patchett, welcome to Fresh Air. I thoroughly enjoyed your book of essays. Thank you for being here. I'd like you to read an excerpt of the title essay from your book, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. And it's about your second marriage. Your first lasted less than a year. And you write about the history of divorce in your family. Like, you had a divorce, your parents divorced, your mother divorced again and remarried, your grandparents divorced, your great-grandparents divorced.
So we were really good at it.
So this is an excerpt about after your parents separated and your mother followed her boyfriend to Nashville. So you and your sister went to Nashville, too.
One night, my mother and Mike came home from dinner and announced that they were married, which, much to our horror, seemed to mean that he wasn't going home. Several months later, I came in from playing to find a boy a few years older than I was in the kitchen. I told him to get out of my house, and then he told me to get out of his house. That was how I discovered I had four step-siblings. And that was how my stepbrother, Mikey, discovered his father had remarried. I can only assume those books about how to discuss divorce and remarriage with your children had not yet been written, or that no one in this time-strapped, cash-strapped family, consisting now of six children, had the resources to go to the bookstore.
I can't believe you found out that way.
Yeah. Well, and you know, as weird as it was for me, it was so much worse for my step-siblings because they didn't know that their dad had remarried. I mean, they got off the plane, they went in the house, and nobody had told them.
Now, you got married for the first time when you were 24. It lasted less than a year. And you write that you knew it was wrong, but that you did it anyways, which I think I understand, but explain.
I think a lot of people do this. You know, you're in a relationship and you know it's not right, and you just think, it's too late. You know, we've been together too long. Oh, we're living together. How would I get another apartment? Oh, we got engaged. How could I break it off? Oh, the invitations have been mailed. You know, and the fact is, there comes a day when you've got to go, and you go. And you look back and you think, it would have been so much kinder if I had gone when I knew I was supposed to go, instead of lying to myself and thinking it might work out and staying too long.
After you got divorced, you didn't want to get married again. And you write that it was actually kind of liberating to date men while thinking you weren't interested in marriage. And there's an excerpt of an essay about that that I want you to read.
Sure.
And this is from the title essay in the book, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage.
Right. And this is really true. Here's a fail-safe recipe for popularity. Be 26, cheerful, and completely over the idea of marriage. Not in a coy way, not in a way that says you secretly hope someone will talk you into it. Wash your hands of wedlock and watch the boys fly in. At the moment that other women my age were starting to ask their boyfriends if their intentions were serious, I was explaining to mine that life was short, and this was fun, and that was all. Well, that's not entirely true. I remained serious about love. I just gave up the notion that marriage was the inevitable outcome of love. I took my mother at her word and had some wonderful, long relationships with people I deeply enjoyed but would not have wanted to marry for a minute. Once I decided I liked someone well enough to want to spend time with him, I set aside my judgment. Did he leave his clothes in a twisted pile on the floor? Fine by me. I wasn't the one picking him up. Was he always late for everything? That could wear over the course of a lifetime, but for a year or two, it wasn't really a problem. Did I find his father impossibly grating? Yes, but who cared? We were not going to be spending holidays together for the rest of our days on Earth. Not only was I dating for the first time in my life, I could put aside the constant assessment of character that talk of forever inspired. I decided instead to fall in love with a good sense of humor, a compassionate understanding of Wallace Stevens, an ability to speak Italian or dance on a coffee table.
And that's Ann Patchett reading from the title essay in her collection, This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. So you were determined not to marry. You are married now.
Yeah, I am.
And you were with the man.
Funny how that works.
You were with the man who became your husband for 11 years before you agreed to get married, because he had wanted to marry much earlier. He had been married, his wife left him, and he's the kind of guy who feels like he needs to be married, which was the opposite of how you felt after your divorce. So you lived separately for a long time. Why was that right for you at the time? Did you feel it was like the best of both worlds, being in a long-term relationship, yet having the kind of privacy and independence that living alone can bring?
Well, I loved him, and I wanted to stay with him. But getting out of that marriage when I was 25 was so hard. I really had that sort of Scarlett O'Hara, as God is my witness, I will never be hungry again. You know, I'll never get trapped. I will always know the location of all emergency exits at every moment. And so I thought, well, you know what? This is going to have to work on my terms, which is I want to live alone. And I'll be true. I'll be faithful. I'll see you every day. We'll have dinner together every night. But I don't want to get married and I don't want to live together. It was good. I loved it. It was genius. And there were times when Carl and I, in that 11 years, would have problems. And I would think, it's so much better to have a fight and say, I want to go home, than to have a fight and say, I don't want to live with you anymore. I mean, it really gave us both a tremendous amount of space. Carl needed time to get over being divorced, and I needed time because I had psychological problems and didn't want to live with anybody ever again. And it really gave us a very healthy, solid foundation for what is now our marriage.
What got you ready for marriage was a health crisis that he had. You want to explain what happened?
Yeah, Carl is a doctor, and he's an internist. He went up to the Mayo Clinic because he said he wanted to have a physical, and he just wanted to get away and not go see one of his friends. And he failed a treadmill test, and it turns out he had a cardiomyopathy. And I went up to Minnesota to be with him. And I thought immediately, well, we have to get married. So we were in the airport in Rochester going home. And I said, well, so I guess when we get home, we'll get married. And he said, yeah, I guess we will. And that was it. You know, we got home and got married. That was it.
Okay, a kind of technical question. So part of the reason you got married was that so you could be the next of kin with the right to make decisions for him medically and get all of those rights and privileges that are only afforded official family in a hospital setting and in other legal situations. But you could have still been married and lived in your own home and not sold it. So what made you think that if you were getting married for these technical reasons? Right, okay.
He was sick. You know, I needed to get going. Like, I put my house on the market. My stepsister is a realtor, and she put my house on the market, and it sold in 4 hours. And because I lived 3 blocks away, I just kind of put everything in my car and drove back and forth for a couple of days. But I needed to be there for him. And, you know, make no mistake about it, this is the love of my life. I loved Carl with the full force of my life. And even though I thought, wow, I have seen marriages fail and fail and fail. I failed at it. Everyone in my family failed at it. I love this person so much. I don't want to fail with them. So I'm going to come up with a new way to do this, a new way to be with them forever. And it's going to work. I'm not going to mess it up.
So we've talked a little bit about how you were married and divorced, and then with another man for 11 years before you felt ready to marry again, even though you loved him very much. You didn't think you wanted to get married until he got really sick, and you decided to get married. And then he got incredibly better, but you were really glad you're married. But you also, you never wanted to have children, and you don't have children.
Right.
But you always did want to have a dog.
Right.
And you had a dog. Do you know why you never wanted to have children?
No, but But here's my analogy to it. People would say to me, and I will tell you the best thing about being 50 is nobody asks me anymore, and I'm so grateful for that. But it would be like if somebody said, your car keys are in the drawer. And you go and you open the drawer, and not only are your car keys not in the drawer, there's nothing in the drawer. The drawer is empty. And you come back and you say the keys aren't in the drawer. And they say, no, go back and look again. They are in the drawer. And you go back and you open the drawer and it is empty. And that's how I always felt. Like people were always saying to me, go back and look again. Examine the inner contents of your heart. You will find it. And I never did. Not when I was tiny, not when I was in my 20s. And I don't think it's a big deal. I think that the world must be full of people who just don't want to have children. I like children. I'm really glad other people have children. I'm happy to be around children. I just didn't want them.
I think there's only been a brief time in history when women actually had the choice of whether to have children or
not. That's true.
Because, unless you were infertile, it would be impossible to have sexual relations with your husband or anybody else without the constant chance of getting pregnant. And now through birth control and through changing social expectations, it's possible to not have children and still be an accepted person in society without being looked on as like a pitiful, childless woman.
Here's a really interesting point that I've just started thinking about in the last few years. I went to Catholic school for 12 years, and I wasn't raised by nuns. I had a family, but I was with nuns the whole time I was growing up, and they were my role models. They defined my moral code. They set the rhythm of my days, and they were career women who didn't have children. They were women who said, I have this thing that I really want to do. I want to devote my life to God and not get married and not have children. And those were the women that I was around from the time I was 5 until I was 17. And it was really much, much later in my life that I thought I had a ton of role models of strong, smart women who said, basically, I want to follow my career. My career is God.
If you're just joining us, my guest is novelist and essayist Ann Patchett. Her new book is a collection of personal essays called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. You also write about your grandmother and taking care of her when she was very sick. And I think so many people have been through similar experiences. Your grandmother was in her mid-90s when she died. She had dementia. She'd broken a hip. And you write, even after she broke a hip, she seemed held to life by about 3 silk threads, but she didn't die. She simply got worse. And that experience of like knowing that death is inevitable, knowing that like true healing isn't going to happen, but watching that slow and fast, then slow and fast descent. And this is a really difficult question to ask or to answer, I think. She wanted to die at some point, or at least she said she did. Did you ever get to a point of almost wishing that she'd die because it was so difficult to watch the pain that she was in and the disorientation she was having and the lack of capacity that she had anymore to do anything or experience anything?
Oh, my gosh, that's not a difficult question at all. I wanted her to die every day, and she wanted to die every day. And that is absolutely what I wished for her with all the love in my heart. She had the most excruciating, endless death. I mean, really, she was 96. She was blind. She was demented. After she broke her hip, she couldn't walk. And her teeth were falling out. It was just terrible. And we took fantastically good care of her. And for some reason, she just kept going on and going on. And not only is that not what she would have wished for herself, nobody would wish that for themselves. I mean, I think that anybody would want a better, faster death than that. And there's nothing in the world wrong with wishing that someone would die. But the lesson is you can wish all you want, and it doesn't mean a thing. Your wishes don't have any impact on the outcome of life and death.
You say that with such ease that there's nothing wrong in wishing that someone would die. But I think so many people, when having a loved one for whom death is inevitable, you know, in the near future, who's like really sick and really incapacitated, and even though that person might feel, I wish my loved one would die, that they feel really bad and guilty for even daring to think that.
That's so sad. They shouldn't. They shouldn't at all. You know, you put all the energy that you have into loving that person and into caring for that person, and you wish ardently for their release. And again, whatever you wish doesn't make any difference. But why we should beat ourselves up in our hearts for what we feel? No, I don't believe in that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is novelist and essayist Ann Patchett. Her new book is a collection of personal essays called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. So you decided to open a bookstore in Nashville after the two existing bookstores closed. And you write, you wanted the kind of bookstore that valued books and readers above muffins and adorable plastic watering cans, a store that recognized it could not possibly stock every single book that every single person might be looking for, and so it stocked the books that staff had read and liked and could recommend. Talk a little bit about what bookstores have meant to you in your life as a reader.
Bookstores, and I think this is true for so many writers and obviously all readers, they're just their home. You know, it's the place that you go and you feel comfortable. I never go into a bookstore and feel like, oh, I have to buy something. You know, somebody, it's not like a dress store where somebody's watching me and I think, oh, I've tried on 20 things. I really need to buy something. You can pick up 20 books. You can talk to the booksellers for 2 hours. You can just sit in a chair and read. And it's not about, I'm going to buy a book. Although, you know, yes, I hope everybody goes into their bookstores and buys books. But it is the comfort that I've always felt being around books. I'm never lonely when I'm around books. It's the world of endless possibility and opportunity to be in that building full of books that can come home with me.
Ann Patchett's collection of personal essays is called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage. You'll find a longer version of her conversation with Terry online at freshair.npr.org.
Chapter 1 says to love her, you love her with all your heart. Chapter 2, you tell her, you never, 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 ever gonna part. In Chapter 3, remember the meaning of romance. In Chapter 4, you break up, but you give her just one more chance.
Oh, I wonder, wonder who
wrote the book of love.
Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer and technical director is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Sit for Life and Herman Miller, featuring the Aeron chair, including the true black color. Sit for Less is now sitforlife.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts since 1985. CySimsFoundation.org. And from Sony Masterworks, with Simona Dinnerstein's new album, Bach, Inventions and Sinfonias, featuring the 2- and 3-part inventions, at Amazon now. This is NPR.